Good morning. Welcome to the first ASAP meeting for the year. First of all, I'll start off with apologies from Hans. Hans is in Saudi Arabia at the moment, so as Vice Chair, he's asked me to look after the ASAP meeting this week. Firstly, what I want to do is introduce our newest member to the ASAP meeting. The new chair of the Korean Accounting Standards Board, just announced last week, Er Hyung. And because Chung Woo warned me that I wasn't doing a very good job with that pronunciation, the gentleman in question has said that he is happy for us to call him E.H. Kim, which is what they did at PwC, and I'm very happy to take that on board. So welcome very much to ASAP. We're lucky enough to have you in at the IFAS meeting in Taiwan last week as well, so you've had quite an introduction to standard setting in your first week in the job. So welcome. Now, with no further ado, we'll turn to the agenda, and our first item this morning is rate regulated activities, agenda paper one. And Michael will be helping us today, and another apology from Jane, who is also in Saudi Arabia.
So good morning, everybody. And the rate regulated activities session today is really just an update to you for let you know what happened with discussions at the board last month on this. But perhaps just maybe to start with just reflecting back. Back in December, we spoke to you and went through a number of our staff proposals relating to the model that we've been developing for rate regulated activities. And we also spoke to the board and gave the board an education session in December in which we provided them with an overview of the model that we've been working on, and spoke to you a number of times about, and the board were keen and happy for us to continue exploring that further, which we started to do in February. At the February board meeting, we looked at the model's general approach, the scope of the model, and criteria for recognition of regulatory assets and liabilities. I'll just maybe just touch on a few of the latest slides and come back to the question slide for you. I think slide five just highlights some of the three key elements that we've been looking at and building into the model as we've been developing this and through discussions with you, which is obviously the importance of making sure that any regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities that we develop in this model are consistent with the definitions of assets and liabilities in the new conceptual framework. We've been looking at how we can use the principles of the IFRS 15 standard to help us develop principles for this model, and also looking at a way that will provide this information about the effects of rate regulation on the performance of an entity in a transparent and understandable way. And the approach we've been taking is to take a supplementary approach to the model so that an entity would apply all other IFRS standards first, and then the model would focus on what are the additional adjustments that need to be recognised to reflect the additional impacts of rate regulation that haven't already been recognised through other IFRS standards. Slide six sets out the core principle that we put to the board in February, and it's that the entity would recognise regulatory performance adjustments to depict the transfer of rate-regulated goods or services to the customer base in an amount that reflects the compensation to which the entity expects to be entitled in exchange for those goods or services. So, as I say, the focus is on this adjustment element rather than trying to depict the performance of the business as a whole, because we've already got IFRS 15 picking up the customer relationship interactions already. And the basis of this model being, as I know we've spoken to you before, that at the start of the regulatory agreement, the contract, the agreement between the entity and the rate regulator is effectively an executory contract, and what we're trying to capture with these adjustments is the extent to which there are differences in the transfer of economic resources between the entity and the customer base that's imposed on the entity by the rate regulator. And where there are these imbalances that aren't already picked up by existing IFRS standards, that we should try and capture these. The slide number 8 talks about the supplementary approach, which is very much saying apply the standards first and then apply this supplementary approach, the additional adjustments that would be recognised, needed to recognise this imbalance from the executory contract point of view. And slide 9 just highlights the scope criteria that we've been focusing on here. So the entity carrying out activities subject to a formal regulatory pricing, i.e. rate setting framework, that is binding on both the entity and on the rate regulator. And that this regulatory pricing framework would establish how the rate is calculated, how the rate reflects the satisfaction of the entity's regulatory obligations, and then adjusts the future rate for these imbalances in the performance between the entity and the customer base. I think those were the things that I particularly wanted to highlight there in terms of the model. In terms of the board's discussions, and I'll give you some of the key points. I think on the general approach and the scope of the model, on the whole, the board were supportive of us continuing in this direction. The board certainly were in agreement with the outcomes that we were getting from what we had presented, but they've asked us to look in more detail at how we're describing this interaction between the entity and the rate regulator and the customer, and just go back and revisit some of the ways in which we're looking at that. On the recognition of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities in particular, the board were not convinced with our arguments and discussions about including a highly probable criterion there, which we took or borrowed from IFRS 15, which is about highly probable there be no significant reversal of cumulative compensation recognised. That's something which the board weren't convinced about, and that we're going to go back and take another look at to see whether that's needed, in fact, given that this is a supplementary approach. So IFRS 15 revenue will already have that in it. There would be no change to that. So do we need to apply another highly probable criterion on top of what IFRS 15 will have already required the entity to consider? That's a summary of sort of where we've got to with this. We do have a question for you related to this, but before I do, I just want to ask if any of the board members wanted to add anything at all from last board meeting discussion.
Michael, I'll throw in that there was some question about whether or not we needed the concept of the customer base for this exchange. So I think that's something else that clearly you would see in the papers, and I think is going to be the subject of further debate. I think that relates to your point with people. I think board members thought we were going in the right direction in terms of a model to develop, but questioned whether that was adding unnecessary complexity in terms of, as you said, how we explain the principle.
Yes.
But I just think that phrase has gathered a lot of attention.
It has. And there were some concerns about the use of that phrase, and one of the things that we'll look at is to see whether there are other ways of describing it. I suppose what we want to try and communicate, perhaps through other descriptions, is this fact that when the regulator is imposing a price change on both the entity and the customers as a group, that although this isn't part of an individual contract with an individual customer, nevertheless, they customers as a group are going to be obliged to accept what the regulator is imposing on the customers as a group. And so when the regulator is making an adjustment, it isn't making any compensation for the fact that the population of customers in year two is different from the population in year one. It simply imposes the price change on the customers in year two. And it's capturing that aspect that we want to try and communicate here through what we've been using so far as the term customer base.
And a lot of the board discussion, from what I remember, was about articulation, wasn't it? So I think most people agreed with the outcomes in terms of debits and credits, but it was the articulation.
Yes.
And a couple of the things we focused on, because these debits and credit balances were sort of described in the paper, this is my shorthand, as where one of the parties had overperformed relative to the other, and there were some questions around whether it was appropriate to characterise where the customer had paid the amount they needed to pay. Was that an overperformance in the period? And also some discussion about what the nature of the performance obligations were, if we're building on that thinking from IFRS 15. So, for example, if the rate-regulated entity needs to perform maintenance, is that the performance of some sort of rate-regulated activity or not? And I think that's what this, you guys are going to go and look at in more detail to bring back to the board discussion. Do you think there's any particular areas where input from ASAF would help you with your next steps?
I suppose, first of all, the customer base point would be helpful to get any thoughts, if you have any, on alternative ways of describing the phenomenon that we see from the effect of the rate regulator looking at the customers as a group rather than as individuals. The other area would be, I mentioned the highly probable criterion, which the board said, you know, look, take another look at that. What reactions that you've got, because I'm not sure that we've necessarily looked at that in a lot of detail with you previously. So again, if you've got thoughts on the importance of that or the lack of importance of that, that would be helpful to hear as well.
Well, I'm not sure if what I'm about to say will necessarily help or not, but I'll give you my views on it anyway. I think starting with the idea that this is the model is a supplementary model, I do support that. I think that is the only way of making it workable in practice, that you allow IFRS to deal with the normal transactions with the customers in a normal way, and this is then an overlay. I think that's both practical and also helpful in terms of signalling this is a kind of special accounting we're creating to deal with a specific situation. So I think it's helpful in that way. I think in terms of having a go at trying to apply the IFRS 15 ideas to rate regulation, I understand why that's been done, that people looked at that and said, well, there's some revenue going on here, there's some goods and services being transferred, there's some kind of performance obligation, so maybe that's a good thing to do. But when I look at particularly the way it's described, and I think some of the concerns you've outlined about how it's being described, the premise of it and why it's not a natural fit, I think I've got two concerns about that. One is technical and the other is kind of, does it actually reflect the economic reality of rate regulation, the type of defined rate regulation that this project is focusing on. So if I start with the technical first, if I pick up this idea of customer base, and I appreciate that's a central part of the model, that instead of thinking of the individual customers that are buying the goods or services, you're looking at them as a collective whole, almost like it's a single customer, and the regulator is effectively acting as an agent for that pool of customers, and it's like it's a single body as opposed to the plural concept. So you're then converting the plural into a single base. But even if I think of that single base, and I'll just talk about credits because that's easier to do, that at the end of the day you've got a regulatory credit balance, and what does that represent in the context of IFRS 15? Because IFRS 15 is not dealing with any old performance obligations, it's dealing with a particular type of performance obligation, which is to deliver goods or services to the customer. And so if you have a credit balance under IFRS 15, it tends to be one of two things. One, it's either because the customer has paid in advance and you haven't yet delivered the promised goods or services, which I don't think is happening here because your customer base acquired the electricity, water, whatever it is, during the reporting period. They've already got delivery of what the customer base is required for that period. And I also don't think it meets the criteria for a refund because they're not entitled to a refund for the goods or services that they've received in that period. What they're actually going to have is in the future, they're going to pay less for the goods or services that they get in the future. So even if I apply IFRS 15 thinking to a rate regulated environment, it doesn't resonate with me that that's a good depiction of the regulatory balances. And when I ask myself why is that, it really comes to my second point about what I see as the economic reality of rate regulated activities, is that it's not just about revenue, it's also about costs. So what the rate regulator is looking at, they're not looking to just control the price. That's really a means to an end. They actually also want to control how much profit the entity makes. That's ultimately what they want to do. They want to make sure that they're not making too much profit and therefore taking advantage of customers who is perhaps the entity's got a monopoly or it's an essential public good or service that the public need to have, so they don't want to extract too much profit, but at the same time they want to ensure the continued viability of that entity so that they can carry on delivering. And that's why the rate regulator looks at not only how much revenue have you made for the period, but what does it cost you, both your directly attributable costs and all a whole pile of other costs, like we've talked in the past about cost recovery for flood damage, research projects that you've undertaken, depreciation on your PP&E, and that would be determined by how much the regulator agrees is a cost that goes into your PP&E base that you can then recover over time. So essentially I see the regulatory balance as a net number that takes into account all the revenues and expenses for the period. And effectively, it's to do with the difference between what you've actually profit you've actually made and what the regulator considers to be an acceptable level of profit for that activity. And then, if you've made too much, and they say, oh, okay, as a consequence, we want you to earn less over the next few years, therefore you have to reduce the price in order to reduce your profits. Or if you've had some unexpected expenses and they've agreed, yes, you can recover those, and so you get your debit balance. That then allows you to charge more in the future in order to compensate you for the fact that you've made a bit less cost than what you expected. So I kind of see it as a net concept, and that's why I would prefer to see it as a, if you're going to go to the point of putting these on balance sheet, I would prefer to see in the P&L the regulatory adjustments characterised as profit adjustments. And the rationale, getting back to why we're putting them on the balance sheet in the first place, I prefer to look at the higher level concepts of the objective and qualitative characteristics, because you've clearly had feedback from users that they would see this as useful information. And even though some of us are not convinced that it meets the definitions of assets and liabilities, and I think it's fair to say it doesn't sit comfortably within it. So while some people might be more comfortable than others, I think it's fair to say that overall it doesn't sit comfortably with how we tend to think about assets and liabilities. But nevertheless, if it is giving you, if investors are saying this is useful information and we want it, that's why we're doing it. And again, the overlay approach with the special accounting, I think again that would then signal why we're going down the special approach. I think that would be a better way of reflecting what's actually going on. And I think it's easier to think of it that way rather than trying to construct an argument around IFRS 15, which was designed for a different purpose for what rate regulation was defined.
A pretty confirmatory comment. I think some sort of supplement to IFRS 15 is the right approach. I think basically the question is how far we move away from the general concepts with the supplement. If we are, let's say, too close to IFRS 15, some people might argue, okay, we don't need something at all. If we are moving too far away, people might argue we need something completely separate with a different concept. What I think is adding the complexity to this issue is that you can quite easily generate or construct multiple element constructs which partly are in IFRS 15, partly are more in this type of rate regulation, and you can also combine this with a principal agent problem. Just giving you a simple example, let's assume you have an electricity or gas provider and you were looking on consolidated financial statements from a group and you're basically providing the whole value chain, generation, trading, sales, storage, and maybe also infrastructure. And let's assume only the infrastructure is part of the rate regulation we are talking about here with the sort of true-up mechanisms. Basically, a lot of people in my jurisdiction argue, okay, if I only look onto the group and all the rate regulation is intra-group transaction, I don't care what's going on from an accounting perspective because it's consolidated anyway. However, you could argue, okay, if there is a principal agent mechanism at the end, that it's not only that you're selling, let's assume, electricity to the customer, but you're also providing an infrastructure part in an agency role, and the principal is somewhere else in your group, you're adding up, or coming back to exactly the problem we are envisaging here. So I think this interaction with IFRS 15 is needed in any case, because I'm pretty sure you will have in a lot of situations they have this sort of multiple elements where you say some things are, let's say, standard goods or services which are in the scope of IFRS 15, and then we have some other elements which are added on and are basically, I would assume, particularly in part of infrastructure, for example. And then the question is, okay, I'm acting as a principal or as an agent, and I'm pretty sure we can see both types of construction in a lot of jurisdiction, and then I think we are back into this game. So summarizing that, I would assume I think it's quite worthwhile to continue with this IFRS 15 supplementary approach, as we cannot avoid the interaction. I assume.
Thank you. Xinsha?
First of all, I also support the supplementary approach. I believe that IFRS 15 should be applied first and then come to the regulatory activities. And with regard to this project, I think there are three new notions should be clearly, you know, identified or addressed. First, we introduce the new notion of the customer base. This issue has been addressed just now. And the second, what's the transaction we are really dealing with? It's based on the regulatory agreement. And we also addressed this agreement on slide 9. It's based on there is a formal regulatory pricing framework they have. And this framework will bind both the entity and the rate regulator. My question is that in reality, whether there is really pure this kind of arrangement exists, just only binding regulator and entity. Because in my understanding, in China, there are a lot of public service private entities. Actually, when the government or the regulator, they want to make adjustments on the price, the customers, the citizens, the people always involving. And the government should have, you know, should approach public hearings to listen to views, to get the support from the people, from the customer. If the people, the citizen, disagree with this kind of price adjustment, the government will not do that. They would like to provide government grants instead of make adjustments of the price. So in this case, I think the pure rate regulatory agreement, I'm not sure whether do exist. If the customer or the people, the citizen, involving deeply in this kind of agreement, whether it's still, you know, as just someone saying that maybe it's very close, it's still very close to agreement with the customers, not agreement with the government. The government plays a role still, just you know, it's just a simple pricing policy or pricing mechanism. But finally, they should get the approval or get the support from the customer. I think. The what's the real meaning of the rate regulatory agreement? I should make it clear. And the third notion is relevant to the new term of imbalances in performance between the entity and its customer base. It's also a new term, new notion. It's very difficult for us to understand. But in my understanding, it's come from the differences between the actual performance and expected performance, expected consumption of the waters, electricity, But the problems come out when I seek the comments from Chinese stakeholders. They ask me, because this imbalance based on the benchmark that's the expected consumption, expected volume is correct. If as the first day, that's expected the expected volume, expected consumption is wrong, is not correct. They base the wrong population, wrong customers base, something like that. So if then we try to account for the difference between the actual consumption and the not correct expected volume or consumption. Is it a right way to account for these kind of differences? And also, there another case. If in Beijing there are two subway line to provide underground service to the customers, and the train, the price, the ticket price, of course will eventually approved by the government, but it's based on the cost and some certain margin. But at the end of the day, there are two separate lines. One subway line overperformance, another subway line underperformance. And the government will not make adjustment of the price based on individual line. So if they finally they make adjustment, maybe the price will increase. But for one line, maybe they will meet there's some right there. But another one, whether they should account for the obligation, because the price will not adjustment will not based on line by line. So in this case, I'm not sure, because it's also based on different customer bases. It's based on a different management efficiency there. So there are lots of factors to have impact on so-called rights and obligation. What's the rights obligation arising from that? So I also hope that we should make it very clearly what's the imbalance in performance arising and what's the reason back there. And the imbalance in performance, the relation between balance in performance with the price adjustment mechanism. So this kind of issue should make it clear first and then come to the detailed accounting measurement.
Kim.
Thanks, Sue. Yeah, I must say, starting off with this project, I really struggled to see the regulatory assets and liabilities, and so I was quite, I guess, excited with the IFRS 15 concept. And at the last meeting, I said, well, I can get my mind around the concept if we actually treat everything within IFRS 15. And I think that's why the customer base is so important. So it's effectively, I think, as Kimberly was saying, it sort of reduces the many into a single unit. So there's effectively the contract with that single unit. And as I said, I probably, from a conceptual basis, would have liked to have just applied IFRS 15 to that entire arrangement as such. Granted, it may give rise to many complexities, etc. So that's why, as a sort of like a second prize, I could see seeing the IFRS 15 or seeing this regulatory asset and liability as a supplementary model to IFRS 15 just from a practical application perspective, and I think the resulting answer is maybe not too different. Okay, you might have a difference in the sort of gross presentation of items. Under this model, you have your IFRS 15 as your revenue, and then you have this adjustment coming as a separate item. If you were to apply IFRS 15, to this in its entirety, you would just have a net revenue number. But as I think with disclosure, etc., I think one can deal with understanding what those amounts are. So if we start to then say, well, it's not really the customer base, and we now, sort of seeing them as individual customers, then I think, for me, the whole thing just starts to unravel. And then I don't really see the basis for the assets and liabilities. And I think then we are, you know, trying to account for something which doesn't really fit in with the current accounting. So for me, as I say, I would have liked to have seen, as I say, a single model, but am happy with the supplementary model on the basis that it doesn't perhaps get to a very different answer. But for me, the important thing is that there is the customer base. And so effectively you're saying to your customers, we're agreeing to provide you with these services, and the price we are estimating, as Jing Chao was saying, we're estimating the price to be X, but the, you know, once we determine what the actual costs were to produce, etc., well, then we're going to revise that, you know, revise the price. So that's so for me, everything hinges on that. The other thing, and it was similar to what Jing Chao was raising around the, you know, perhaps needing to consult with the customers and getting their buy-in. If I just think about a situation, our electricity situation in South Africa, so although there's a rate regulator and there's a mechanism, the electricity producer needs to make application to the regulator to say, well, based on all of this, we are now applying for this increase, and you know, this is our rationale, et cetera, et cetera. And then the regulator needs to apply their mind, but you know, I'm not entirely sure if it's officially open to you know, customer input, but nevertheless you're going to have consumer bodies, you know, lobbying and etc. And we've had situations where what the producer requested was not approved by the regulator. So that also comes back to your question and comment around the probability aspect. The question that I was going to, well, that I have is, in such an environment, if the if the final approval only takes place after year end, to what extent is it effectively an adjusting post balance sheet event that you now are able to go back to year end and say, at year end we actually had the right to charge more for the services that we've already rendered, or is it something which, you know, only arose thereafter, or is it because we're saying, and that's why I assumed that's why you put in that probability to say, well, you want some threshold to say, well, based on past experience, and you know, not to say that the past is always going to repeat itself, but to say, well, you know, what is the chance of there being a reversal? So if ultimately that new rate is not approved, then you're going to need to go back and say, well, actually we weren't entitled to that, and now we're going to need to make some adjustments. So I do think that, yeah, I think it needs to be clarified in terms of those types of situations. Do they fall within the scope of this, or must that rate have actually been approved by the financial year end in order to say, I do have that right to charge more or to reduce the prices in the future?
And I think it's something we know we need to deal with, but I my takeaway from the board meeting was partly that threshold, there's sort of a sense from the board it was a bit too early to be discussing it because there were so many questions still around the principal, what were the performance obligations, and so it's sort of a flag to come back later was partly, but you're right, those practical issues. I'm just going to go around again. So, Linda?
So, we think it's important that we clearly focus on IFRS 15. That's a new standard. It's a comprehensive standard. And we think, obviously, that's important. We like the layering on of the additional guidance. It makes sense in our jurisdiction because, in essence, these entities identify these separate adjustments, and they track them, and they disclose them. So it's very clear in a particular entity, they have activities that are not subject to regulatory approval, and those would fall right into IFRS 15, and then they have other types of activities that are clearly subject to regulatory rate setting, and those would be incremental. So it fits very nicely in terms of the way our jurisdiction works. I hadn't really thought about the notion of the rate-setting mechanism being approved by year-end because I think the natural practices in our jurisdiction just work with the year-end and that sort of thing. The highly probable thing I think is interesting because I think what you're trying to get at is that a point in time when you're doing the reporting, that the numbers that you're reporting are likely to be realized, to be collected, that they're based on good estimates. And so we track that by looking at kind of the subsequent adjustments where the regulator takes money back, et cetera. And we don't have a high incidence of that, but I think that's what you're trying to get at. So however you articulate that, we do think that's important, because not having some threshold or guidance to make sure that what you're reporting at a point in time is likely to reflect reality would mean that your financial statements aren't relevant, and that's not what we want. So again, we continue to support this project. We do think that the concept of customer base is really important, because otherwise we'll be going back into the mind-numbing discussions we had at transition to IFRS around what if nobody turns on their light switch, or what if John Smith doesn't turn on the light switch because he's not a customer in the second period. And you know, we had all those discussions. We don't want to go back to those discussions. So maybe we don't remember that. So I think in general, it's good progress. That sort of thing. I just want to take a minute and give a quick update where we are in terms of our research paper, because a lot of you have helped us. And so again, I want to emphasize that our research paper is designed to gather data on both sides of the equation, in terms of we want to be objective and we want to. We're building this out. So we have received 11 different responses, excuse me, and request more information about jurisdictional practices. At this point, we have the countries that we've received information from: Belgium, Portugal, the UK, Spain, Germany, the US, South Africa, Japan, and one additional one from Canada through the rate regulated consultative group that we hadn't originally included. We have electricity, gas, water, air and toll roads, and Canada. So we're building out the data in the study. We're still open for business if you've got information you want to share with us. So working very heavily on that. The board is going to look at the next iteration. I read it on one of my long plane rides, but I read it the latest version of the research paper, and the board is getting that next week, and we're looking at the latest version in our March meetings. And we're just keeping pace with the progress of your project so that we're ready to share another iteration. We'll bring it back to ASAP when it's appropriate. We're going to continue to work through it. But thank you very much for those of you who have given us data.
Thank you. As I look around the table, I see Steve. Steve, if it's okay, I'm going to pick on you for a second just to add to the debate, and then I'll keep going around the table. Because I thought Steve raised a couple of interesting points about the threshold at the board meeting. It might be useful for people to understand what some of the arguments were that were raised at the table. So, Steve, if that's okay?
Sure, I thought you might, when the conversation was going on to the threshold. But the points I raised at the table was in response to a comment about asymmetry and a threshold in terms of recognizing the assets, because it seems to me that if we're trying to produce useful performance metrics for the investors, having an approach that sets a threshold for the assets and not for the liabilities isn't going to really achieve very good performance measures. So I'm presuming that when you talk about a threshold, it's in relation to the asset recognition, and that's what concerned me.
Better. Maybe I am naive or I have a too simplistic mind, but I fail to see this imbalance in performance. Let's take the example of an electricity utility based on predetermined tariff by a regulator. The performance by the utility company is to give access to electricity. This was done. The obligation for the customer base was to pay what was the tariff. This has been done. The fact that because utility company has borne more cost for some reasons, and therefore the regulator might for next year increase the tariff. Apart from the fact that, as was said, this is all, in my view, was always or almost always based on negotiation and based on political decisions, because it might be unpopular to increase tariffs and things like that. But even if there is a binding agreement for the regulator to increase the tariff, which I think is a very uncommon type of regulatory agreement, even if it exists, still the utility company for next year has to perform giving access, and the customer base for next year, they have to pay the amount based on the new tariff. I don't see this adjustment going on. Sorry.
We got a strong support to use the IFRS 15 transfer model to this scope here that's presented in slide 9. The question that arose was related to the scope in itself. Because when you see the first bullet here, you say contract activities that are subject to formal regulatory pricing, and you give a rate setting as an example. Mm-hmm. Correct?
Well, by that we mean rate setting.
Yes. Then the second bullet means there is a regulatory price framework to include the rate setting mechanism. What happened in some countries, Brazil is an interesting case because that was in the front page of all newspapers last week, is that there is a regulatory framework, but it's not a regulatory pricing framework. What the government does is he compensates companies. What happened at the moment is the government is that's what the headline is. The government is supposed to pay something like 4.5 billion pounds back to companies because the demand was not enough. The companies they had a minimum ROE that they should achieve providing that service. So what the government does at the end of the day, it does not regulate price, does not establish a rate setting mechanism, so he just pay companies back. So I, in my view, it is a regulatory asset. So companies, as long as it's an asset, should be a regulatory asset because it's originated in this this regulatory environment. But it's not a rate mechanism. It's not a pricing mechanism. It's done on a different way. So. And I believe that this kind of contract that I mentioned here, which is quite is not theoretical, it's not a hypothetical, it exists, should be embraced by this approach here.
That's an interesting one because, as I understand it, in Brazil, the entities, regulated entities, would recognize financial assets or financial liabilities under the terms of the Brazilian regulation. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, this is what they call in football, this was a goal using a hand. Okay? It's just like now is Mano de Dios, Maradona. Just, well, we have to deal with that because you're going to receive that money. The money is legally enforceable. The government is paying, believe it or not. Because what happened is you must go 2 steps back. A little bit of history is important here. The government have been through a large privatization process in Brazil, privatized most of those services. So if he fails to pay that, companies will not renew the contracts. So and most of the private companies involved will not continue to provide the service. So it is a very enforceable kind of obligation. So I'd say that one of the most enforceable kind of obligation that the government has, and this obligation to repay. When you look at this scope here, the way it is written, and take it ipsis literis, as some authors will do, you say, well, this does not apply to what happens in Brazil.
And I suppose what we're trying to capture here is situations where the entity wouldn't be able to recognize a financial asset or financial liability because it doesn't meet the definition. So, but we've got this regulatory mechanism that is creating, or we think is creating, other assets and other liabilities.
No, but companies in Brazil try to recognize financial asset liability and not allow it. Mm. Not allow it.
So
they were not allowed to do so. They did not recognize financial assets and liabilities. But say, well, that's not in accordance to IAS 39. We do not have a financial asset treat in that sense. So it's, in my view, it's an irregulatory asset. Mm-hmm. But it's not a regulatory asset originated from a rate set mechanism. My mind, at least.
Yeah. Soft scope question.
Yes. So you should, omit those words here.
Okay.
I say that the regulatory framework, don't need to be a regulatory pricing framework. And who knows what happens around the world? I don't know.
Alexandra, just listening to the fact pattern you're describing right now, if you think about the kind of supplementary approach that's, you know, described in the paper here, I think, based on what you've just said, and obviously these are complex fact patterns, so this is not giving an accounting opinion at the table, but it sounds like the receivable that you're talking about would be recognized by an entity applying other IFRS before it got to the overlay situation, so that rather than trying to stretch the scope of the overlay approach, that I would expect a promise to guarantee a minimum ROE, for example, to be captured outside of.
I have to see so many heads here saying yes. I was at the time when this problem happened in Brazil. For some, I was a commissioner, the Securities Exchange Commission in Brazil. We came here, talked to ASB, and everybody said no. These are regulatory assets. You cannot recognize a regulatory asset.
And that's why I said these are very complex fact patterns that you have.
So rather than giving a dump counsel.
I will scream everybody saying yes. What happened in the past, they say, well, this asset should not. That's what the difference between Brazilian approach and the Canadian approach. So companies in Brazil, they release two sets of financials.
Okay.
One with the regulatory assets or some sort of financial assets in that sense, and other without, but the IFRS standards in Brazil are without the regulatory assets, because they could not be considered.
So I guess from a staff perspective, why don't we take that to look at, to see if we think it is or is not covered by something else, and then circle back on scope. So
that's it.
That's helpful. Jim?
So directionally, the outcomes under the approach seem to resonate with me. I question whether it was articulated in a way that made the most sense to me, or whether an alternative would be, as opposed to focusing on performance, focus on consideration. At least it doesn't seem intuitive to me to say, for example, my costs were less this period and so therefore I performed less, or my costs were more this period. So I had, I happened to operate a utility where there was a large storm, and so I have asset impairments. It doesn't seem like I've performed more. But the consideration that I'm entitled to from the customer base is likely greater than the consideration to which I've billed my customers.
Yeah.
Same thing when you're in the opposite position. The consideration to which I'm entitled to may exceed the consideration. And so, and it struck me in particular where it said the performance of the customer base. Well, the customer base doesn't perform. What they do is provide you consideration.
Yeah.
And so it resonated more with me if you would focus on consideration from the customer base versus performance.
Yep. That's helpful, thank you. Sven?
Yeah. Don't want to open any of the Pandora's box like IAS 10 or IAS 20. Stay within another interaction within IFRS 15. And I think that's basically coming back to, I think, what Steve mentioned in the last body, and also Michael's initial question on this, what's the right level of assurance and how do we deal with the, let's say, risk of revenue reversals. And I think that's another interaction with IFRS 15 with regard to timing. So I think in a lot of cases we have the situation where revenues from the customer base today is revenue from customers of tomorrow or next period. And so there is, I think, a natural interaction. I think we have to deal with this. And for me, it sounds quite logical that there must be some sort of symmetric solution for that. I mean, you can have the risk to over or underestimate or to have a negative or an additional positive revenue is quite similar. So I can understand these, let's say, concerns or some of the questions I think you raised as well. Is it good to have an extra concept or a different concept for the upside or the downside? So I think it's pretty clear that we have this assurance for the contract from customers with contracts, but anything else is is always, I think, sort of estimation based. I mean, we can discuss what has to be fulfilled at the period end and what is an adjusting event and non-adjusting event. That's maybe part of the further discussion. However, generally speaking, I would say there is always some sort of management judgment or maybe some sort of estimation what will happen in the next period and what might be this extra consideration I will get or I have to give back. And I think this general idea of management judgment we already have in IFRS 15. I mean, even today, dealing with discounts and how do we calculate the exact transaction price is already subject to some sort of judgment in certain cases. So I don't think that we are, let's say, crossing a line for new measurement concepts. So I think we're quite fine. But I think we have to, and I think that's effectively one of the critical points, how do we deal with this timing idea? Because there is always this direction, if I have a regulated revenue now, basically next or 2 years period, I know basically it will be in this normal, let's say, standard revenue line item anyway, and how do we deal with this interaction? I think something we basically started with in December, where we also had this idea is there one or two revenue lines and how do these two interact? And I think that's exactly the question that needs to be clarified here. So the question is good. Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Patricia, you've been very patient.
No, I'm going to start with Michael's questions. We haven't debated highly probable, so we don't have a view on that. We've taken as given that the customer base notion is absolutely essential. We don't see any way you can stand back from it. One of our concerns has been scope. We join with a lot of others in saying market regulation should not be within scope. But then if we listen to the conversations, everybody's talking as if settlement is every 12 months, so we don't have a problem. But if we think about market regulation and assume that the market regulator it doesn't pick a number out of the air, they are developing it for a particular purpose. So, I mean, I can think of a case I dealt with where the government set the price, it was a monopoly, and every 5 years or so they reset a price to ensure that the regulated entity on average was profitable. So at the beginning of, say, a five-year period, it made a profit. By the end of the five-year period, it was making a loss, and the price was reset. So you could think of it as pretty much falling in this with a five-year reset rather than a 12-month reset. And the question is, how do we scope whether we think something like that should be in or out? Because we're all comfortable that something should be out, but I don't think we've quite got the scope right yet. The other thing I think we need to do a little bit more thinking about, and Jim's consideration I think was a really important point. If we think about a volume variance, then we're really comfortable we've got a consideration adjustment. But if we look at other activities like you're going to be funded to build a plant, you'll recover it over the life of the plant. Well, that's not just a price adjustment. It is also an obligation to deliver the goods or services over that period of time. Should we be making some distinction between a pure price adjustment for goods and services delivered and a price adjustment for goods and services which the regulated entity is required to deliver in the future? Because then, in this case, Michael's argument that we start off at the beginning with an executory contract falls apart. So I think we've got some questions there that I'm good at asking questions. I haven't yet worked through an answer for myself. Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting discussion. May I ask James now, Jim? Would you give us some kind of clarification on their performance by a customer and kind of performance by a customer A? So do you see any difference between these two?
So in the overlay, I think the overlay approach deals well with the transaction between the company and the individual customer. Although even there, I don't view it as customer performance. I view that as customer consideration of whether they've paid the consideration. I just thought in an overlay approach, if you focus on consideration due or payable to the customer base versus getting into whether you have performed additionally to the customer base or not, because I view it as I think, as Alberto said, is the performance is you delivered the goods or services to individual customers. And I think the overlay feels more to me like it's really consideration adjustments, not performance adjustments.
Alexandra.
Final question here is, would this model apply to FX regulation? The central government guarantees a given FX rate, pegged currency situation that arises from time to time in countries to countries. China has that sometime, and Venezuela has that, Brazil had that at a given point in time. So I pay you certain amount of US dollars from my local currency. And this is different from the market price of that currency. So if you look at my assets in my local currency, if you translate it to US dollars, for example, you can use the government guaranteeing one given price and the market applying a different price. So it's a form of rate setting.
I would see that's quite different. I think the key feature here to me is the regulator setting what the compensation will be for the services, the regulated service that is provided. Whether that is the setting the revenue amount, or whether it's setting the profit amount, which was that had been brought up, one or other of those. But what you've just described, I don't see a revenue or profit commitment coming through in that sense.
I'm not clear. Is it the government, let's assume that pound dollar market rate is 1.2, the government say, well, I'm going to pay you 1.5 to you. So it's a pegged currency. No, there's a lot of examples of that. So it's the government saying, I will pay for your asset a certain exchange rate, which is different from the exchange rate that's current in the market. They do that from time, very unorthodox macroeconomic policy, but you know, it happens from time to time in different countries. So they are guaranteeing a certain exchange rate, and they guarantee you a certain someone saying stop.
Don't have anything.
Someone disagrees. That's my wife, actually.
It's probably worth myself and Jane having a discussion with you separately to sort of get to a better understanding of what it is that you're describing, because it's certainly new to me. I've not come.
Yeah, it's not the very macroeconomic textbook. It's a pegged currency.
But then at a minimum, we probably need to be clear whether it's in an out or out.
Yeah, which is instead of floating currency, pegged currency.
So, given that I've managed to let you run half an hour over the time, then have you got something quick to say?
Yeah. To say that, I think this entitled consideration is maybe a good working title, a starting point. It reminds me a little bit on this revenue requirement idea. I think that's not that very far away from that idea, saying we have an absolute number of revenue, which might be P times Q, so sometimes it's a quantity aspect, sometimes it's a pricing aspect, and maybe consideration is an easier way to handle it. However, conceptually, I think we need to be careful what's the reason for the true-up, because sometimes it might be a performance difference, so we have performed more or less, or the timing of the performance is somehow adjusted, and sometimes maybe it's more a measurement adjustment, or really a transaction price adjustment, so the total transaction price goes up or down, but we have performed exactly as envisaged. So, and that's something maybe we should keep in mind, that the reasons for the revenue requirement, or the reasons for this consideration might come from different angles, and that might be one of the risks I see when we just use one term for that, we are putting too much things together. But maybe if it's easier for people to handle, I'm fine with the working title.
Okay, so I think we've got lots to think about.
We have. No, that's been great, actually.
Anything, Michael, that you want to clarify before we wrap up? Are you good?
I think I'm probably good. I mean, I took a number of points away there. I mean, there was the profit point that Kimberly raised, the government interaction, Xinjiao, who you said about sort of the government may decide to give a grant rather than require the customers to pay an increase in price. And I think we have already looked at aspects of that, but we need to just think through that further. A number of points on customer base and the importance of that, and certainly that's, you know, my own point of view, that the customer base is a really important distinguishing feature here that I think we need to retain, but obviously, you know, continue to work on.
Okay, thank you. Lots to think about. So with that, Michael, I think you're staying at the table.
Indeed.
Changing topics and layers coming in.